Funds for the California Report are provided by Chevron, investing in renewables, strengthening communities, and creating jobs. More information available at chevron.com. The California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org. And URS Corporation, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical services to public agencies and private companies. URSCorp.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Rachel Miro. Scott Schaefer is away. Coming up, how arts organizations are staying alive in tough economic times. Plus, a woman who's a paralegal by day and a rapper by night. She couldn't choose between two loves.
I thought that by the time I grew up, I would figure it out. But I ended up pursuing both at the exact same pace, at the exact same time.
Also, Hmong American poets in the Central Valley writing their story. And a new rockumentary about an L.A. punk band with a storied past.
Sex, drugs, rock and roll for sure, but also ego clashes, racial tension, religious fanaticism, mental breakdowns, attempted kidnapping, and courtroom drama.
It's the California Report. It's the weekend, and for a lot of us, that means a concert or a play, or perhaps something participatory, like a workshop or a dance class. On this week's show, we decided to take a break from our usual format and focus exclusively on the arts in California. We start asking how arts organizations, big and small, are faring in these challenging economic times. We checked in first with Laura Zucker, who directs Claremont Graduate University's Arts Management Program. She's also the longtime head of the Los Angeles County Arts Commission, which divvies out millions of dollars in grant money to hundreds of nonprofits.
Well, I think this recession, of course, is one of the deepest we've all ever experienced. So that's true for arts organizations as well. But the good news here is that almost everyone is staying afloat. We have really seen only a handful of the more than 350 organizations that we fund annually go out of business. Almost everyone else has found a way to adjust their programming, freeze hiring. People have not stopped attending arts events. Just the opposite, in fact. If you're not going to be able to afford a big expensive vacation away from home, staying home, having a stay vacation, and going to the John Anson Ford Amphitheater, for example, where your average ticket price is $20 or $25, can be a great option.
You know, in private industry, when the going gets tough, you see a lot of consolidation or big organizations gobbling up little ones. Are you seeing any consolidation in the world of arts and culture?
Interesting question, because there was a lot of discussion about that amongst funders. And funders sometimes feel that there's too many arts organizations out there, mostly because they see them all beating a path to their door to seek funding. But in fact, if you look at the proportion of arts organizations to our population, we are very far from being saturated. There is, in fact, a place for all of these organizations. It's kind of like saying, do we have too many parks? Do we have too many libraries or bookstores? You know, it's like how many? You can't really have too many in a way. So although there was this theoretical discussion about consolidation, in fact, we aren't seeing it happening.
It's interesting that you mentioned different agendas, perhaps, between funders and organizations. And that leads to this question I have regarding a recent report by the National Committee for Responsive Philanthropy that found 55% of the grants in the U.S. go to arts and culture nonprofits with budgets bigger than $5 million, which is another way of saying that a tiny group of nonprofits, less than 2% of the scene, are getting to eat up the majority of the money. And we're talking things like opera houses that deliver Western European art to primarily white, relatively wealthy audiences.
Yeah, this is I think a really important report that grantmakers in the arts brought forward at their recent conference in San Francisco, and about which there was very robust discussion. Of course, my perspective as a government funder is really different. Government funders are in the job of spreading the money throughout diverse communities and supporting the entire arts ecology. So it's partly, I think, educating our foundation partners about the viability of funding smaller and mid-sized organizations which better address our culturally diverse communities. I would just also really add that in LA, of course, we're one of the most diverse counties, I don't know, on the planet, certainly in the United States. And when you go to the LA Philharmonic and you go to the LA Opera, you see a great deal more diversity in some of our major institutions' audiences than I think you might see elsewhere in the country.
That was Laura Zucker, head of the Los Angeles County Arts Commission. I also talked to Craig Watson, director of the California Arts Council, which focuses on underserved communities all over the state. What does that mean? As an example, he gives us the $25,000 the council gave to the Alliance for Traditional Arts based in Fresno.
That's not a huge amount of money, but we know that through that grant, that programming is leveraging every one of those dollars to find and celebrate and support some of the most marginalized artists among us. And that's whether it's Native American artists or new immigrant community artists. Sometimes it's not through a direct grant where we can have a bigger influence.
You may be thinking to yourself, with a budget crisis we're having in Sacramento, there's a California Arts Council. How does it get funded? 60% of its $5 million annual budget comes from the arts license plate, the one with the palm trees on the left and the sun on the right. What arts organization do you give to, and why? Let us know with a comment on our website, californiareport.org. You don't have to be a hip-hop diehard to understand the genre's appeal. Catchy musical riffs, lyrics that pop with wit and sometimes politics. Our next story explores how one young woman heard the siren call of this creative art while in law school. Molly Samuel has more.
Hopi's latest album is Raw Gems.
I got a song in my heart and I sing it off key. Throw it on my sleeve, put some eyes to eat.
Hopi's a petite 27-year-old with a sweet face and a warm voice. On stage and in her music videos, she's a confident performer with a sassy, sharp delivery. At her home in San Francisco, she's embarrassed by her bedroom.
Oh my God!
She says it's too messy, but she has an excuse.
Oh God, I recorded a music video in here.
I wanted the idea that you can create entire ideas and movements, albums, music videos, all that stuff you can create from your house.
She's made 3 music videos for her new album, and they all feature some combination of scenes in front of San Francisco landmarks, on public transportation, and in her living room. Hopi, whose real name is Kay Hope Renoa, has been making music in her room since she was little.
So I actually play the violin, which is what most hardcore rappers do when they first start.
Hopi's first album, Diamond Dame, came out in 2008. On the album, you can hear her influences, the groups from California she grew up listening to, Farside, The Hieroglyphics, and her mentor, Del the Funky Homo Sapien, who makes a guest appearance.
What do you see?
The whole thing about Bay Area hip-hop is that it's really about the individuals.
Oakland journalist Eric Arnold has been writing about hip-hop since 1994.
Everyone from Del to Lyrics Born to The Conscious Daughters to Krayshawn, you know, the E-40, we're talking about individuals there.
He says Hopi's part of that diverse tradition.
I mean, she has an image, you know, it's kind of like this refined B-girl, you know, like I'm a classy lady, but I can still take you out in a rap battle. But, you know, when you listen to her music, she's just really kind of talking about expressing herself, and it's really just like, I would say, good old-fashioned hip-hop in a contemporary context.
And like any current 20-something, she's a multitasker. Hopi was in law school at UC Hastings when her first album came out.
When I was in school, I wanted to divide the two, but things would come up. Like I would read my book, my case book, and there would be a case that would take all my effort to not drop my book and start writing a rap about it.
Law school inspired her in other ways, too. While her first album had a more straight-ahead sound, her two more recent ones, Dulce Vida and Raw Gems, have a lusher sound, more complex beats, and she sings more on them.
We'll be in love for eternity. This I could say with absolute certainty. Any gaze that me eyes glaze with purity, all in my body gave way to maturity.
When I did Dulce Vida, I was damn near living at school. In the library or in bookstores, classical music in my headphones. And that's Dulce Vida, that's where it came from.
She graduated last year and works at her mom's firm as a paralegal. She fled the Philippines with her family after then-President Ferdinand Marcos was overthrown. Even though both of her parents were lawyers in Manila, the family wasn't wealthy, and Hopi says she had a tough childhood.
I grew up poor, an immigrant, and a child in a low socioeconomic bracket, which is prone to crime and as well as a lot of injustice. So I grew up wanting to both change the system from within, become a lawyer, learn about different ways that I can help my community, and I also wanted to talk about it.
Wait a second, I'm secondary to none. One. Every eardrum, you feel it in your tear ducts. Whack rappers such as Fry Up in they seven and Seagram's grass buses get these brass knuckle raps and they...
Rap and the law both have a focus on language, the meaning of words, how they fit together. And there's an element of performance in both pursuits, too.
When I was little, I wanted both. I didn't say rapper or lawyer, but I wanted to be a musician. I always wanted to be on stage. And then I also wanted to be a lawyer. And I thought that by the time I grew up, I would figure it out. But I ended up pursuing both at the exact same pace, at the exact same time.
So for now, Hopi's sticking with both of them, paralegal by day, rapper on nights and weekends. For the California Report, I'm Molly Samuel.
You can see one of Hopi's music videos on our website, californiareport.org. Our next piece explores how a group of Hmong Americans in the Central Valley have embraced literature as a vehicle to tell stories we don't often hear outside the tightly knit Southeast Asian community. This weekend in Fresno, a reading will celebrate the release of a groundbreaking collection called How Do I Begin? Jefferson Beavers has this introduction to the writers and their project.
Do you know that letting go is a kind of beauty? I recall a poem you once recited to our children. It was not yours, but you wept anyway. You always weep for the things that will never be yours.
That's Burley Vang, reading from his poem, Eating with the Poet. Vang's parents, like many Hmong, fled Laos in the late 70s and resettled in the U.S. after the Vietnam War. Vang grew up in Fresno. He earned an English degree from UC Davis and a creative writing master's degree from Fresno State. He loved to read and he loved to write, but there was one problem.
I wanted to read stories with Hmong characters in there. But nobody was writing about about us.
Some say the Hmong community lost its written language thousands of years ago through forced assimilation under Imperial China. For generations, the Hmong have depended on what Vang calls heritage art forms, bamboo instruments, textile art, and oral stories. Those oral stories change over time, sometimes with each new telling.
I felt like I didn't have an identity because nothing was written down. Things are just always sort of changing and in the air.
For the Hmong, a written culture has developed over the last five decades. Vang founded the Hmong American Writers Circle in 2004. The eight-member group fosters creative writing in the Central Valley's Hmong community, and they put together the new anthology, How Do I Begin? Now, the current generation's history is being preserved and shared, this time in writing. But the writers, writing in English, have experienced growing pains. Like other American children of immigrants, their identities often live between two worlds.
And it's funny because you're living in a past that you never experienced, but yet you hold so close and so dear to you because your parents keep reminding you of what they went through.
Some of the book's writers, like Vang, are first-generation Hmong Americans, but others were born in Laos, and they bring with them the heartbreaking stories of refugees.
My name is Sol Vang, Sol Cho Vang. My Hmong name is Cho.
Sol Vang, no relation to Burley, is a poet. He is believed to be the first Hmong American to earn a master's degree in poetry from Fresno State in 1999. He also served in the U.S. Army.
I was born in 1962, so that's really the start of the war in Laos. The intense fighting started. So throughout my childhood, I have always lived with war.
Sol Vang's family came to the U.S. when he was 11. He says the refugee experience, for him and for many Hmong, was like waking up from a dream. His past, his present, and his future, everything felt taken from him. He knew he had to write about it. Here's Sol Vang from the poem that inspired the anthology's title.
Now here I am, adopted citizen, not rooted in this land, unable to taste the spirit in its dust, to sense its moods in the pollen. How do I begin my song? Where do I enter the chorus when my part is not yet written, when the conductor won't point my way?
Sol Vang says for many writers in the book, it was a struggle to identify themselves. The questions piled upon them.
Do I write for Hmong, or do I write for Americans, or do I write for Hmong Americans? And who is my reader? How do I define myself? And so even though wasn't a question that was asked explicitly, everyone instinctively answered that question.
For the writer's circle, the anthology marks a big jump into the American mainstream. Connie Hales teaches poetry at Fresno State.
This book is essential because it's full of voices that have not been heard yet. And that's important in California and also important all over the place.
Burley Vang hopes the book inspires young writers, Hmong or otherwise.
Because I think everybody has a story to tell in their lifetime. And if you don't tell it, once you're gone, your story dies with you. It doesn't matter who you are, where you're from.
Members of the Writer's Circle will now focus on writing new works of their own. For the California Report, I'm Jefferson Beavers in Fresno.
You can hear the complete versions of poems by Burley Vang and Sol Vang online. Look for the links at californiareport.org. Rock bands rise and rock bands fall, but rare is the rockumentary that captures the drama with the force of everyday sunshine, the story of Fishbone. Ahead of its theatrical release this weekend, the California Report's pop music critic Steve Hockman reviews the film, chronicling the excitement and the heartbreak of a band that burst onto the scene with great promise back in the 1980s.
I've seen them do every style in the same song.
They were so inspiring because they were so unique. They influenced a lot of people to go on and do their own thing and take what they could from Fishbone.
They should have been the band that went way beyond any of us that were influenced by them.
That's LA underground music kingpin Mike Watt, No Doubt star Gwen Stefani, and Primus leader Les Claypool talking about the band Fishbone. Well, Fishbone back in the late 80s and early 90s was the band that a lot of people thought would go way beyond anyone else in the LA scene. The Red Hot Chili Peppers, Jane's Addiction, you could ask them too. Filmmakers Lev Anderson and Chris Metzler did for the fascinating, at times heart-wrenching new documentary, Everyday Sunshine, The Story of Fishbone. They could have asked anyone who saw them back in the heyday, six wild African-American kids storming the largely white punk clubs, awing everyone, including yours truly, with their rock, funk, ska, metal, reggae, fueled by equal measures of musical accomplishment and kinetic anarchy. It was, as their early anthem says, a party at ground zero, and they were the house band.
Party at ground zero, every move is starring you, and the world will turn to stone if you step on through. Party at ground zero, every move is starring you, and the world will turn to stone if you step on through.
Everyday Sunshine is the latest in a rockumentary subgenre we might call purgatorial pop persistence. A band has a thrilling rise, dramatic fall, and, well, keeps going somehow, believing it can regain the glory, more often than not comically delusional. Anvil, the story of Anvil, chronicling a Canadian heavy metal band, is the recent archetype. This one lacks that film's head-smacking real-life Spinal Tap angles, but it's got everything else. Sex, drugs, rock and roll for sure. but also ego clashes, racial tension, religious fanaticism, mental breakdowns, attempted kidnapping, and courtroom drama. This, says narrator Lawrence Fishburne, a Fishbone pal since his days as an 80s Hollywood club bouncer, is a story that could have happened only in L.A. We see, partly in some fun Fat Albertish animation, Norwood Fisher, his brother Philip Fish Fisher, Walter Kibbe II, Chris Dowd, and Kendall Jones taken in the first waves of 70s school busing from black South Central L.A. to the very white San Fernando Valley, where they meet disturbingly cheerful Angelo Moore, already a, excuse the phrase, fish out of water living in the suburbs. They coalesce into a band right from the start, charting their own course. Signed to a major label pretty much right out of high school, the next few years seem magical. Alt-rock radio success, a Saturday Night Live appearance, and even a Spike Lee video for the song Sunless Saturday. But The Downfall also has an only in L.A. character, as the band just can't straddle those cultural freeways that divide the city. To the whites, they remain exotic. To the blacks, they remain oddballs. Record executives get desperate for a hit, and what had been a true democracy of friends turns into, as trumpeter Kibbe says, a me club. We see frontman Moore become increasingly erratic, and most dramatically, with the band set to play the 1993 Lollapalooza tour, guitarist Jones tips into religious mania and quits the band. An intervention gone wrong leads to the attempted kidnapping charges. The band is left in tatters, down to Moore and bassist Norwood Fisher, keeping it going while battling both each other and their own demons. There may not be triumphant redemption to be found in this tale of the career that got away, but there is a certain amount of reconciliation. In a latter-day clip, Kendall Jones sums it up.
There was just nothing we were afraid of tackling. We didn't care what everyone else thought. And we may have suffered for it, but so what? You know, that's how we listen to music. That's how we play music.
The story doesn't end here. The current incarnation of Fishbone has a new EP out and is back on the road, with a chance to prove to old fans, and hopefully some new ones, the real takeaway message of the movie. Fishbone made what was and remains some startlingly good music.
Steve Hockman is a Los Angeles-based writer who covers pop music. He reviewed the film Everyday Sunshine, the story of Fishbone. In recent years, the San Francisco Bay Area has become a major U.S. conduit for Spain's greatest flamenco artists. They're not just passing through. The local scene is helping to organize their American tours. Ahead of this weekend's Bay Area Flamenco Festival, we asked the California Report's jazz critic, Andrew Gilbert, to explain why and how flamenco caught fire in Northern California. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Rachel.
Andy, San Francisco's Caminos Flamenco produces the annual New World Flamenco Festival in Irvine. A San Francisco woman is curating next month's Flamenco Gitano in New York City. What is going on in the San Francisco Bay Area?
There's a lot of history behind it. It didn't just flare up overnight, Rachel. I mean, going back some four decades, you had Theater Flamenco de San Francisco that was presenting shows, holding dance classes, and bringing artists from Spain. So in a lot of ways, the audience has been cultivated for decades now. What's really happened in the last, 10 or 15 years is you've got artists like Yalisa, who presents the festival in Irvine, which has been a huge success and really made an impact. And then Nina Menendez has become a major force, and she's the producer of the Bay Area Flamenco Festival. And she has started to bring in the greatest artists from Spain, in many cases artists who haven't performed in the United States or in California or haven't been here for decades.
And this particular year, the Bay Area Flamenco Festival has a really big headliner.
This year, she's got Sigala, who is really breaking out of sort of the flamenco scene because he has collaborated with artists all over the map.
He's won Grammys.
He's won a couple Latin Grammys. His first one, and he's still sort of best known in the United States for, is for an album with Bebo Valdez, the great sort of Cuban piano patriarch, and they did a gorgeous album. But he's also collaborated with Latin jazz musicians in New York City, with tango musicians, and he is a really charismatic performer.
Hoy entra en la calle de tu corazón, donde la mañana un cambio de color, y la lluvia riega los campos y trigales, las matas de olivo y los cañaverales.
What's so fun about Sigala is, you know, flamenco is this soul-bearing music, but he performs with this sort of twinkle in his eye, with this smile, where he's just so clearly enjoying himself, even as he's just, you know, spilling out his guts.
He's not the only anchor for this festival. We also have the guitarist Diego del Morao and the dancer Jose Maya.
Morao's performance, what makes it sort of particularly weighty is that he's performing a tribute to his father, who was just a legendary flamenco guitarist, comes from one of the great Roma musical families in southern Spain. And he died a couple months ago. I think he was about 54, really young. So there's a real sense of the torch being passed to a new generation.
Being passed, I found it really interesting that Del Morao and also Maya are going to be hosting not just performances but workshops for local dancers and musicians in the San Francisco Bay Area and in Santa Cruz.
Well, that's been a big part of the sensibility of the flamenco scene and these festivals is, you know, teaching and bringing this music to people who are interested. So here's a chance, you know, to get together with the greatest figures. And it really is an art form that is passed on, you know, hand to hand.
Beyond the festival, it seems there's really a vibrant scene here that is essentially host to big events like this festival.
It's true, and smaller events. The Theater Flamenco of San Francisco, they've got their festival coming up, and that's mostly local artists who are really, you know, impressive in their own right. And they bring in artists from Spain, too. But, you know, they're also holding classes and holding concerts, you know, during the year.
Andy, thank you for talking with us.
Always a pleasure, Rachel.
Andrew Gilbert is a San Francisco Bay Area writer who covers jazz and world music. And that's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Racho. Seal Muller is our technical producer with additional engineering by Howard Gelman. The senior online editor is Gabriel Cohn with help from David Marks. Our interns are Rigoberto Hernandez, Rebecca Wolfson, and Bridget Bodner. Our producers are Victoria Malione and Amy Machado. Ingrid Becker is our senior producer. I'm Rachel Miro. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. The California Endowment, building healthy communities because that's where health happens. More information at calendow.org. And the SunPower Corporation, offering high-efficiency solar energy solutions to households and businesses in California and worldwide. The world standard for solar. SunPowerSolar.com.